I now have 8 o'clock on my clock, so you may start this morning's Dhamma talk. And the first 2 full days of this retreat, Saturday and Sunday, are now past. Today is Monday. And the first 2 days of any retreat, you like to keep nice and soft, simply because many people are tired, having to overcome what I call sleep deficit. You don't really rest enough at home, and you struggle to get the time to come here. Some of you travel from a long distance to get here. And so I always like to keep the first 2 days nice and soft and easy. And the experience which made me do this was when I gave a retreat in Sydney many, many years ago. And one of the retreatants there was a very high power executive of some big company. And she arrived on Friday night, almost about midnight, because to get the time off work, she had to, as they say, tie up as many loose ends as possible so she'd get a whole week off. And the first talk she heard on a Saturday morning when I was telling her to be kind to your body, and she understood that and followed the instructions. So immediately after the talk, she went to bed. And she got up just in time for lunch, and after lunch, she went to bed again. And she spent most of the first couple of days just sleeping. And I encouraged her to do that, even though I remember her telling me in the interview time that in that retreat center, you did not have your own private rooms. You had to share with maybe 3 or 4 people to a room. And she said that every time that she was awake, the other meditators in her room were looking at her with such anger that she was sleeping all the time and not meditating. And I told her that was not anger, that was jealousy. I only wish they had the guts and nerve to do the same. And it was true, because after 2 or 3 days, she recovered from her sleepiness. It was nothing to do with any defilement or fault in the character or any laziness. It was just nature, cause and effect. She'd been working really hard, stressing out, and her body needed to take the time just to relax. So the first 2 or 3 days, she did hardly any meditation at all, but a lot of sleeping. And after 2 or 3 days, obviously, she was behind everybody else. But the next 3 days, she caught up with her level of meditation. But the wonderful thing was, it was a 9-day retreat. The last 3 days, she just exceeded everybody. She was one of the star meditators on that retreat. And I often quote her example of saying that if you just push through your sleepiness, it's there with you for the whole retreat, and you never get very, very deep. It is an investment for the later part of the retreat, being kind to your body in the first part of the retreat. When the body is really relaxed and peaceful, it's just so easy to meditate. If the body is really tired, you're struggling to keep awake. You're struggling to be mindful because your body is telling you, no, 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 I need to take a rest. So please take on board the example of that lady. She really needed to rest. And for those of you who know your Buddhist history, you know that's exactly how the Buddha practiced before he went under the Bodhi tree. A good rest, a nice shower, a meal which was prepared for a heavenly being. That's what he ate. And we get just pretty much similar from all the people who come to feed you. Meals fit for kings and queens is what we eat in Jhana Grove. And so we eat well, we sleep well, and then when the Buddha actually meditated, I like also to impress on this point. For those of you who have gone on pilgrimage to the holy sites in India, when you go to Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha did become enlightened, you can imagine what it must have been like many, many years ago. In fact, the first time I went there, it was very, very simple. There's hardly any people there. That was in 1972, I think. Hardly anybody there. And now, of course, it's a very busy place. But you can imagine what it must have been like on the banks of this beautiful river. Lots of trees. It was like a garden. It was like a park. It wasn't a very harsh place or ascetic place. It was the sort of place that, you know, you go on a picnic in the afternoon. If you're an Australian, you have a barbie in that place. But it was a calm, quiet, peaceful place with good water, good air circulation, and probably hardly any mosquitoes. And that's the sort of place where he chose. And he didn't sit out under the tree in the bush. So it didn't sit sort of out in the hot sun. It was under the shade of a beautiful tree. And he got some grass from a local grass cutter to make a really big cushion for himself. And that's how he meditated. In that bit of comfort, first of all, looking after his body, first of all. So then his body could leave him alone so he could work on his mind and meditate. So that is one of the reasons why this place is comfortable, good food. Your own room with ensuite, a nice meditation hall here, to try and make it as comfortable as possible, and also to encourage you to rest if you need to rest. Because if you're in here in the morning sleeping, you're wasting your time. If you're sleeping in the morning, nodding and snoring, it's much better you do that in the place for nodding and snoring, which is called BED, bed. So if you're going to sleep properly and look after your body. But after two or three days, people's sleep deficits start to be paid off, and you start to get more energy, you start to acclimatize to the routine of Jhana Grove, you learn how to be more quiet so you're not talking too much, and also you accustom yourself to know where things are, so you can relax after two or three days, which is why I usually wait until now to start talking about how to meditate, once the preparation is there. And usually, the most common form of meditation taught by the Buddha was the Anapanasati, the meditation on the breath. So that's going to be the subject of this morning's talk, meditating on the breath. And even if you do read the Buddha's advice on meditation on the breath in places like the Anapanasati Sutta, there you will find that the first thing one does is the preparation to find a nice quiet place to meditate. Yeah, it is true that it's not the noise disturbs you, but you who disturb the noise. An Ajahn Chah can do that. Maybe an Ajahn Brahm can. But some of us, unfortunately, we're not at that level yet. And we do get disturbed by noise. So we try and find a reasonable quiet place, but it can't be totally quiet. There's no place in this world, it seems, where there's no noise. So because of that, we try and make it as quiet as we possibly can to find some silence. But if you cannot find perfect silence, the noise which is left, that is where we start to practice. It's not the noise disturbs you, but you who disturb the noise. Because it's as good as it gets. But one little method which I have been cultivating to create that silence wherever I go is to start visualizing a little bubble. And I create my little bubble around me, and in that is where I meditate. And creating this little boundary by the surface of the bubble means what's outside really is none of my business. And I can sort of meditate just about anywhere now and not being concerned with all the noises which are outside of me. So you have to do that preparation first of all, as best you possibly can. I'll be talking more about that tomorrow when I start talking about the difficulties and problems in meditation. But first of all, you get yourselves as quiet as possible and also as comfortable as possible physically. And you find a comfortable posture. You can use these Zen stools, sit on the floor, sit on the chairs, wherever it is as comfortable as you can possibly get. So put some attention into your physical comfort first of all. And there's so many tricks to get comfortable. We have so many cushions, and if the cushion isn't fat enough, put another cushion in there or change it around. And I've often said, and people still have not taken me up on this, if meditation is becoming so popular these days, that there is a big market for high-tech meditation cushions. The ones which you have, these little round things over there, they are, as they say, so last century. Surely we can do better than that in our modern world. And I've got many ideas. That little cushion can have different compartments. And with a remote control, you can press like left, and the left part of the cushion expands to lift you up this way. Or the right part, under your knees, if your knees need lifting a bit, you know, it can put you up there. And I've been on these, fortunately, that I've got some sponsors, and sometimes they upgrade me to business class. And on business class, you can press another button, you get a massage on your chair, which is really nice. So you can get one of these cushions. Another button, it can massage you in case you're a bit stiff. And it's always a problem that sometimes it's too hot, sometimes it's too cold. We cannot make it okay for everybody here. There is an air con, but when we put the air con on, someone turns it off because it's too cold. And other people turn the air con back on because it's too hot. And there's always people messing around with the aircon, because for everybody, you can't please everybody. But if you have your own cushion, just like in some cars, you can press a button and the seat warms up. So we can have a cushion where if you're too cold, you can press the button and it warms your bottom. If it's too hot, it cools you down. And the last part of my high-tech meditation cushions, another little button on the remote control of your cushion. And if you have sloth and torpor, you can get a latte or a cappuccino. A little coffee machine at the bottom there. So that way, you'll have the high-tech meditation cushions. I'm sure they will sell a lot in our modern world. But the whole point of saying like high-tech meditation cushions is just, you know, be comfortable when you sit. Because a lot of time people keep saying, well, you know, my meditation's no good. Please give me some advice on how to meditate properly. And a lot of time it's preparation is not there. You're sitting in a stupid posture, you know, being so tight and tense because you're too cold, you're too hot. No wonder you can't get in deep meditation. So look after your body, first of all. It's just like when I was a monk in Thailand. The first time I went up to the northeast, I was really low energy. And I asked the senior monk, please, can you give me some meditation instructions so I can have more energy when I'm meditating? And he just looked at me and said, the very, very deepest meditation instructions I've ever had. He said, eat more rice. I wasn't eating enough. And he'd noticed that. Just an obvious solution. I didn't have enough gas in my car, enough petrol. I kept running out because I wasn't having enough nutriment. And I just followed his advice. I made a bigger bowl of rice to eat for my one meal of the day, and it worked. I just had more energy. Sometimes the most obvious solutions are the ones which we miss. And we go for the complicated ones. So it's the same. If you're sleepy, how do you overcome sleepiness? Go to bed. Obvious. Sleep a bit more. How do you overcome feeling cold in meditation? Get a blanket. How do you overcome too hot? Take the blanket off. Obvious stuff. But people want sort of the refined stuff. So get the obvious answers first of all. And then, once you have, you know, the posture just nice, in a reasonably good place, the best you can possibly get, then the next thing which the Buddha says in the Anapanasati Sutta is establish mindfulness as a priority, even before you start to watch your breath. Get mindfulness going first of all. Now, those of you who haven't heard my teachings before, you may have heard that that particular phrase in Pali, translated as establish mindfulness in front of you. And it does not mean that. When it means in front of, it doesn't mean physical. It means it putting it in the top of your list of to-do things. That's why the word in English, priority, is a perfect translation of the Pali word. Priority means putting it top of the list, putting it the most important thing to do. Get that done first of all. Because when people hear the word mindfulness in front of you, number one, there is no you. So where on earth can you put this mindfulness? But people in Asia, they always thought they lived in their heart. So for them, mindfulness in front of you was up here somewhere. But in the West, we think we're up here. Which means that you put your mindfulness in front of you here, and they do the stupid tip of the nose stuff. It was amazing when we had the first heart transplant. And actually many people, especially in Asia, thought, oh my goodness, who are they going to wake up as? Are they going to wake up as the person who had the body or the person who had the heart? And now, of course, we know it's the person who had the body. But imagine they have the first brain transplant. Imagine that I have a stroke or a heart attack and that my brain is still functioning and your brain isn't, and so you get my brain. When you wake up, will you tell bad jokes? Will you be Ajahn Brahm in a new body? Who will you be? Most people think, oh, that's an interesting question. They love to see the result of the first brain transplant because we really identify the person as being the brain. So, Ananda, if you get my brain, you'll wake up as Ananda, unfortunately. Unfortunately, depending which way you put it. But the brain is not the person. So when they say in front of you, you know, it doesn't mean in front physically, it means putting it as a priority. Get mindfulness established first, before you even try to watch the breathing. And that is an important point, because many people miss that, and they start watching the breathing really early on in their meditation, which means they can't sustain their awareness on it. The mindfulness is not strong enough yet. You haven't built it up yet. So you're watching your breath and it goes all over the place. And so what do people do? They hear the teaching, oh, if you wander off, bring the mind back again. It wanders off, bring it back again. It wanders off again, bring it back again. And after a while, you get fed up bringing it back again. Because it always goes off and bring it back again. Wanders off, bring it back again. It doesn't work. Why is it wandering off? So this is where you establish a little bit more mindfulness. Your mindfulness isn't strong enough yet to watch the breath. So which is one of the reasons why even the Buddha said, establish some more mindfulness of your body, first of all. Get that strong, first of all. Because it's much easier to be mindful of your physical body than it is to be mindful of the breathing. Even though the breath is part of the body, but the main body is much, there's much, too, much more going on in your body. Which is one of the reasons why we do walking meditation, to get really aware of your body. One of the reasons why, you know, we do looking at our body, scanning it, sweeping it, relaxing this, relaxing that. It's not just to have a healthy, calm body, it's also to develop mindfulness, to get it established on something which is far easier to establish mindfulness on, your body. And it is amazing just how unaware, especially Westerners, are of their body. This was first explained to me by Ajahn Chah in northeast Thailand. When we went on alms round, we didn't wear any shoes. And so walking through some of the forest, we would always tread on little roots coming up, stump our toes on rocks, and we were always injuring our feet. And even me, I had so many band-aids on my feet because of stubbing my toe here and puncturing on a sort of a root somewhere else. And when Ajahn Chah saw this, he was amazed. Thai monks didn't have any wounds on their feet, only Westerners. And so he coined the word that Westerners have stupid feet. And how accurate that was. Our feet were stupid because we had no mindfulness of them. All our mindfulness was up in our head, thinking about the meaning of dependent origination or Panchupadana Khanda or reincarnation or the nature of non-self. We were really good at that. But actually walking without hitting your feet, we were stupid at that. Our mindfulness was not on our body. And it's also one of the reasons why people get so sick in the West. You're not aware of this body in which you live. Once you're aware of it, it's amazing just what you can do to heal it. You can see it needs something. You can feel that it needs a rest. You can feel it needs exercise. Your body can tell you what it needs if you pay attention to it. But are we paying attention? No, we're too busy going somewhere. Too busy watching the movie. Too busy, I don't know what we're doing in life, but very rarely do we actually have mindfulness of our body. In this retreat, mindfulness of the body, please. So even when you're walking from here to the toilet or to the dining area to have a cup of tea or going back to your cottage, your room to have a rest, be aware of your body and how it's walking. Feel it, get to know it. And then you will actually find that the awareness of your body starts to tell you exactly how the body feels and what's going on. And eventually you'll be able to avoid so much sickness in life. Even little things like you get sick. I really have a lot of sympathy for doctors in the West. You get sick and you go to see the doctor and the doctor said, well, how does it feel? I said, it's painful. But exactly what type of pain? There were a million different types of pain. Which one? Well, I don't know. It's just painful. Imagine this poor doctor trying to guess from just incomplete symptoms, just a general, it hurts. I don't feel well. That's actually one of those terrible jokes about the banana who went to the doctor. You know why the banana went to the doctor? Because it wasn't peeling well. It was terrible. I got that from an 8-year-old kid in London somewhere. He should have stayed in London, I apologize. But it's so hard being a doctor, just trying to understand what the patient means. Because the patient doesn't have much awareness of the body. So we develop this awareness on our body, you know, with things like walking meditation, sitting down and making sure your body's really relaxed. And I do this, you know, even though I've been meditating a long time, just finding a part of the body which is not balanced, which is a bit sickly, like the hay fever, just the tension, the tightness, the throbbing in the bridge of the nose because the sinuses are starting to get a bit inflamed, the itch and the palate. All these little things you get very aware of. So once you get aware of it, it's amazing. You just relax it all and a lot of times the problem disappears. But at least you can be so aware of it. And when you're up, it's okay, some interesting, great stories. Years and years and years ago, I've done this since as well. Years and years and years ago, I went to Canberra for the first time. Canberra is a really cold city. And I didn't realize how cold it was. And so just after one day, I developed a cold, sneezing. In the morning, it wasn't so bad. But the people looking after me, they decided, they had planned that day to take me around seeing all the sights of Canberra. All day. And of course they got lost and, it took so much time. And so all day, which was on the road, getting more and more tired. And because I couldn't rest, the cold was getting worse and worse. And I was really sneezing and coughing and all this terrible stuff was coming out of your body. And we managed just to get to the temple 5 minutes before I was supposed to give the talk. And that was terrible. I felt like death. Should have gone to hospital, not give a talk. But all these, it had been advertised and all these people were coming to listen to me. So I thought, right, let's give it a try. I asked for a cup of tea. You know what I got? Chinese tea. It's got no oomph to it. I call that Mahayana tea. I like Theravada tea from Sri Lanka. So anyway, that didn't really help. So there I was really in trouble. All these people waiting to listen to a talk. And I start giving a talk and then sneeze before I finish the sentence. Start the sentence again and then cough. Another half a sentence and I have to wipe my nose because stuff is going down into my mouth. And it was really hopeless. You know, if you try and give a talk when you're, you know, in the middle of a stinking cold, it was just a waste of time. You can see when people aren't paying attention because, you know, they start to look at their clock, they look at down, and they just look to the left and look to the right. You realize, you know, you're losing everybody. But before they actually went out of the room, no, it's only about 5 or 10 minutes into the talk, I said, right, we'll meditate first, and then I'll give a talk. Half an hour meditation. So they're all into that. And that gave me the chance to work on my cold. And after half an hour meditation, then I gave this amazing talk without a sneeze, without a cough. All it took was half an hour to get rid of that cold. And the people said, well, the talk was okay, but what was really amazing, where the hell did that cold go? That cough, a real full-on cold, but you look at your mind, get it really peaceful and still. It's amazing what you can do with your body. And I've done that quite a few times. It's wonderful when you can do that, because it means when you have to perform, you have to do something, coughs and colds, you know, who cares about those? You can actually do something with them. So, mindfulness of the body is a great thing to develop. It will give you so many benefits. Yet it does not get you to full enlightenment, but at least it makes you healthy. And at least it gives you the opportunity to develop really deep meditation. So spend time being mindful of your body. And then what you're doing, you're arousing, building up that awareness, that mindfulness, that stillness. The other thing with mindfulness on the body is you can't have too much conversations with your body. You know, you've got like an ache in the knee or the a stomach ache. Now you can't really get a big conversation on about that. You start watching the mind, and it's right next to the brain, and oh, you can just fantasize, you can think, you can philosophize all day, you know, thinking so much stuff with your eyes closed. But when you're in your body, you find the thinking is just pretty much subdued. So it makes you calm and quiet when you're aware of the body. And if that doesn't work, you can just go for a walk along the paths in the forest because nature is also something which calms you down. At the last conference we had over here, was it here or somewhere else, I forget, but there was one fellow, a psychologist, who was making a fortune teaching the obvious. And he said he started a new type of therapy called nature therapy. Which all he did, all his clients, he took in his car, he's in Sydney somewhere, off to the bush, into the Blue Mountains, by the ocean, beautiful little places, had a nice walk with them, and they felt so much better afterwards. And he had a nice time too, especially when he got the payments, the checks. Because it works, obviously. You know, well done for actually seeing the obvious that... I don't know why you need to go with a therapist to go to the countryside or to the beach or to the ocean. You can go there by yourself, save a lot of money. But it works. Just being in nature, being in a calm, unthreatening environment, you find actually you just relax. Because you're not thinking so much. There's just too much which is beautiful to watch. So even if you just walk through this forest, you find that produces a bit of mindfulness, takes you away from the thinking. So all of those things support getting enough mindfulness, and when you sit down, scan your body, feel the body until there's enough mindfulness, that then you can watch the breath without much problem. By not much problem, I mean breath going in, breath going out, breath going in, not just for one or two breaths and then the mind wanders off again, you have to bring it back again, but for long periods of time. No problem at all, because you have enough mindfulness, the awareness is strong enough. Another example to make it quite clear, that you know, you see that I shaved my head this morning because today is the full moon day. This afternoon I'm trying to stop the interviews a little bit early because I have to go over to Bodhinyana Monastery for the fortnightly recitation of the rules called the Patimokkha recitation. But I waited until it was very light before I started shaving my head, because if I tried to shave this in the dark, you would see lots of blood and wounds on my scalp. You have to really be aware to be able to shave your hair without cutting it all over the place. Just like watching the breath, you have to have awareness first of all. The lights of the mind have to come up. Mindfulness has to be strong so you can see what you're doing. When you can't see what you're doing, you start watching the breath and it goes all over the place, thinking about this, fantasizing about that. Your mindfulness isn't powerful enough. So once the mindfulness is powerful enough, then you can watch the breath and it is easy. So if you're watching the breath and you're wandering all over the place, don't think more willpower. Okay, really get into this. Come on, watch the breath, or else. Then you find you can't watch the breath at all, and you get stressed out, depressed, frustrated. That's not the way to meditate. You know you have enough mindfulness if you can watch the breath easy. No problem at all. Watching the breath going in, breath going out. Because the mind is bright enough. And once you can start watching the breath, yeah, there will be some distractions, an itch on your body, a sound outside, but keep the breath as your main object of attention. And the simile which works the best on this is a simile of the television set. If you're watching the TV, the next time you watch the TV, if you haven't done this already, notice that before you turn the television on, you can see the edges of the screen and what's to the left or right, above and below the screen. You can see just what's behind. But after a few seconds, your mind fits exactly inside the television screen. And you are unaware of what's the left or right, above and below. You're not even perceiving the edges of the screen. If any psychologists want to try this experiment, try a triangular TV set and a circular one, and a polygon TV set. Just try them and you will find after a few seconds you don't even aware of what the shape of that TV screen is, because your mind fits inside. This is another opportunity for someone to make a fortune. Designer television sets, not just rectangular like every other television set, but imagine like Star of David television set. You'll make a fortune in Israel and New York selling Jewish TV sets, you know, with a star on it. Or you can have like round ones for people who like football. You can have oval ones for people who like Australian rules or rugby. Amazing just what you can actually do, because it is true that you actually fit your mind into the screen. I know that because every now and again you have to fly on the aircraft and they always ask you to see the safety video. In the old days, people would actually do that. That was part of the flight attendant's job. But these days, they just put it on a screen in front of you. And in economy class, they're really small screens. But once actually you start watching it, your mind actually fits inside. People apparently these days watch movies on their iPhones. A tiny little iPhone. But you find once the movie starts, you actually can just, your mind fits inside. Just in that little square, you can do that. Other times, you can go to people's houses, have these huge TV sets, massive ones. They're totally a waste of money. It doesn't matter how big the TV screen is. You only notice how big it is when it's not turned on. Once it's turned on, your mind actually fits inside. Now, the reason I say that simile is not to save you money. Actually, when I first did this, this was really good because somebody was about to buy one of these huge TV screens. And when they heard me, they said, oh no, just a small one's okay. And they gave the difference to the nuns' monastery as a donation. Hell, you really, really smart marketing by Ajahn Brahm. But in this particular case, the meaning of the simile is that when you start meditating, say on the breath, your breath, make sure it's in the center of the screen. Sounds, aches and pains, difficulties, no, distractions, they're on the edge of the screen, okay, over here somewhere. And you'll find after a short time, your mind actually fits into the breath. And everything else to the left, the right, above and below falls off the screen. You can't experience it anymore. It's called focusing. Our problem is, yeah, we're watching the breath, and then someone makes a noise, and the noise or that person comes into the center of our screen. That stupid person, they're always making a noise, always sleeping in the morning. I'm going to tell Ajahn Brahm, I'm going to get like something to throw at them. I'm going to get like a pea shooter, so anyone who's snoring, like hit you with a pea shooter, or something. Now, I'm sure you've had thoughts like that. So you see, the breath has fallen off the screen a long time ago. And all the stuff, the rubbish about the distraction has totally dominated your awareness. Because you put the problem in the center of the screen rather than keeping the problem out here somewhere. So, when you're watching the breath in the center of the screen first, please. Everything else, you can still be aware of it. You don't need to get rid of it. It will get rid of itself. It just falls off the screen. Sound, noise, heat, whatever it is, keep that on the edge of the screen or even beyond the screen. Center of the screen, always with your meditation object, the breath. You don't need to use force on that. It's just, you know, where you train your mind to watch. It means you don't have to get rid of stuff. If you try and get rid of stuff, you're focusing on the stuff. To stay with the breathing, the rest of the stuff, not really my business. So when you do that, you soon get awareness of the breath, and the awareness builds up because you're being calm and still. The more still you are, the more simple the objects of your mind, the more the mindfulness increases. So you start to see not just the breath, in, out, you see all the different parts of one in-breath. Just like the walking meditation, it's not just left, right, left, right. Just the left step. Which part leaves the ground first of all? Which leaves it last? You see all the different movements of the muscles. Just one half a step, just lifting up and then going forward and then going down. Thousands of different experiences, different movements of the muscles. And you're aware of them. Once the mindfulness increases, it's amazing just what you can watch in just one breath. One in-breath is huge. So once you get that sort of type of mindfulness, you get what we call awareness of the whole breath. From beginning to end. Not just in-out, but just this whole process of breathing, of one in-breath is huge. And that's when it gets very interesting. Of course, that people who never watched the breath before, never got to that stage, think it just must be so boring. What did you do today, they ask me. So I just watched my breath. That's all. Can't you do something more interesting? It was interesting. You must be mad, must be crazy. But the experience actually is that once you really get into this, the breath is fascinating. So that becomes the next stage of the meditation. Now with every stage of meditation, I have to be very careful here, because once I start talking about stages, people's ears prick up. Stages, levels, that's what I'm used to, that's what I like. I want to go from level 1 to level 2, and level 2 to level 3. That's what you're used to. Please don't do that sort of stuff. Because the next level of meditation is right inside the level you're on now. You just got to deepen what you're experiencing right now. You deepen your mindfulness of the breath, and then you see the whole breath from beginning to end. You don't move from one stage to another. You go deeper in the stage you're on right now. Go deeper in and deeper in and deeper in. And that's where you find the next stage. So it's not progress. It's ingress. Going in. So, the mindfulness increases, and you, from just watching a breath, then you watch the whole breath from beginning to end. So don't try and do that. That's what a lot of people do when they start talking like this. Say, okay, I wear the breath. Now I am going to go on to the next stage. I'm going to watch the whole of the breath. Come on. It does not work that way. If you force it, you will just destroy the meditation. You look at your peaceometer or stressometer, and the stressometer has gone to 10. You're trying too hard. Just relax, and it happens naturally. That is the way to meditate. Just keep just watching the breath going in and out, and then this is what happens next. The mindfulness increases when it's ready to increase, and then you can start to see the breath from beginning to end. And I mentioned it becomes fascinating, which means it grabs your attention. You don't need to force your attention on it. You don't need to say, come on, watch your breath. Come on, watch it. Don't lose any moment of the breath. Come on, watch, be careful. No force is required at all. When it becomes interesting, it becomes natural. Do you need to use any force to watch a good movie? Do you need to concentrate to look at the cricket on the TV? Do you need to, you know, to use force, to force yourself to eat your lunch today? Is it, well, I'm really going to eat my lunch today? Of course it isn't. It's just natural because it's pleasurable. And this becomes the next stage of the Anapanasati. You're just watching the whole breath from beginning to end. And it starts to appear lovely, delightful, joyful. And it happens naturally. You can't make that happen. You can't suddenly decide, right, I am now going to enjoy the breath. Come on, enjoy the breath. That's ridiculous, people saying such things. You can't force that. It just happens when the breath starts to become really beautiful. Naturally, because your mindfulness is increasing. And here, you just a little pause for one of the great insights into the way the mind works. Where does that joy come from? Why is not the breath joyful all the time? And that joy, that happiness, just is the result, a natural result, of a mind which is becoming still. The more still the mind, the more joyful it is, and the stronger the awareness, the stronger the mindfulness. If you haven't heard this before, here it comes again, and you will hear it many times on this retreat. I did mention this the first night under the overview of meditation. Two parts to the human mind, the doer and the knower. The doer is the active part which reacts to things which you hear, things which you feel and see, which thinks about it, which plans, which remembers, which feels guilty or sometimes wants revenge. All that active part of the mind, which I call the doer, for want of a better word. If you really want to know what that word is in Pali, it's Sankara. Always doing stuff. Now, that takes up most of your mental energy, reacting and doing stuff. Which means there's hardly any energy left for just knowing, for mindfulness. Which is why most people are just so dull. And if you do a lot and you really struggle, because sometimes life is like that, Sometimes life is so difficult, you really have to put extra energy in, really struggle to keep your head above water. And people struggle, and sometimes they get so exhausted, it's called depression. Mental exhaustion. Struggled, you've got nothing left. You have to give up, naturally. And you get this really, really low mental energy, low mindfulness called depression. And monks don't get depressed. You know why? Because we know how to source mental energy. So if ever you get tired, be really still. And the energy comes back again pretty quickly. Because if the doer is not sucking up all your energy, you stop the doing, let go of doing. Let this moment be. Don't react. Don't want anything. Don't try and get rid of things. Stop doing stuff. And then that mental energy goes into knowing, into awareness. You actually start to charge up, like you charge up your iPhone. But you're charging up your mindfulness now, giving it some boosts of power. And through stillness, you plug into stillness, and your mindfulness charges up. And your mindfulness becomes really strong. You can actually watch the breath. You can watch all of the breath. And with it becomes the joy, the energy. Joy and mental energy are the same thing. Which is why, if you're one of these people who wake up in the morning and you're really miserable and grumpy until you've had your first cup of coffee or strong tea, why does a cup of coffee or strong tea make you happy? Because it gives you energy, mental energy. Now that is like, you know, boring energy, and it's not really natural. But when you're still and peaceful, that's a natural source of energy. And with that natural source of energy, the mind wakens up and also becomes happy too. Stillness gives you mental energy and also happiness. Doing too much causes you dullness, even depression. No happiness left. So all the grumpy people in the world, all the angry people, all it really is they're so tired and exhausted. No energy left. Which is why there's not much happiness. If people would only do less, more still, there'd be a happier human race. And you wouldn't have so many arguments, wars, and grumpiness in this world. Simple thing like that, doing less, more stillness. So, for you, you'd experience this. You'd be sitting here just watching the breath, go in, go out, see the whole breath. And you thought, wow, this is actually nice. It's delightful. And it is one of my purposes is to have as many people as possible get to that level of the delightful breath. But I do call that just a pivot point, the turning point of meditation. Because once you get delightful breath, then you're away enjoying yourself, meditating for hours and hours. You don't need a schedule. You know, sometimes, and I mention this, it always happens every retreat, you're having a beautiful time meditating, just watching the breath, oh, this is so nice. And then somebody says, lunchtime, and you have this big problem. Should I go for lunch? I'm not going to eat again until tomorrow morning, till breakfast. Should I go for lunch or should I carry on meditating? This big inner conflict, which only lasts a second, because who wants lunch? And you carry on meditating. And you always see people like that, meditating here during lunchtime. That's really cool to see that. The meditation is more delightful than having lunch. But look, if you see anyone like that, you know, lunchtime, 11 o'clock, they're still sitting here with a smile on their face, just take an interest. If a person who sits next to you in the dining room, take an interest of what they like and take a little bit for them and put it aside for them in case they come out later on. They're enjoying their meditation. That's so important to help them out there. So look, if anyone does need to sit through lunchtime, please someone else, keep a bit back for them. So they don't have to worry at all. They don't have to. It's a terrible thing. Imagine if that was a Buddha under the Bodhi tree. Time for lunch. And he came out of meditation. He wouldn't be the Buddha. He'd have messed it up because of lunch. So he didn't care. Who cares? Take lunch later on. So, actually he had lunch beforehand, but he was there for quite a few days. So you obviously missed quite a few meals. But when you're having fun, who needs it? And that's actually, you get the delightful breath. Why do you get the delightful breath? Please, for goodness sake, don't think, oh, something's wrong, I'm enjoying myself. Because people always have this idea, anything worth doing, you have to have pain. You know, you're struggling, no pain, no gain, they say. That's the most stupid proverb ever invented. For me, in meditation, no bliss, no enlightenment. That's my saying. Much better say, isn't it? No joy, no progress. Good, isn't it? So what happens is the meditation becomes really joyful and you're just starting. Beautiful breath, delightful breath. You ain't seen nothing yet. It gets better and better and better. And that's why these are the juicy stuff. So you get the delightful breath first of all. It's a pivot point from what they're on. You're going to have great fun. Because you have delightful breath, no more effort is needed. You don't need to watch the breath. Come on, be mindful. You can't stop yourself watching the breath. It's just beautiful. It's delightful. It's amazing. I tell you, what's the delightful breath? And the happiness gets more and more, the more still you are. And of course, that's why a lot of people like coming on these retreats. Why on earth would someone pay, $20 or something and give a donation afterwards as well and help with all the chores and even give, you know, help out in other areas of China Grove and do the washing up and stuff? Why would people do this? Because, and why is there such a big waiting list to get on these retreats? Because people have fun. One lady from Sydney, another business lady, who came on one of my retreats some time ago, again, very busy, she said she had to grovel, literally grovel to her boss to get the time off. But you know, she came on the 9-day retreat. When she went back to Sydney on a Sunday afternoon, evening, she sent me an email on Monday. Said, my boss, when he saw me come back to work on a Monday morning, the first thing he said was this: what have they been giving you in Perth? I don't care what drug it is, but please bring me back some next time. She was so happy, the boss thought, you know, we're giving drugs out here. But the point was, the boss had noticed her happiness level had increased enormously. Now that is what's supposed to happen on these retreats. So when it happens, don't think something is wrong, I'm enjoying myself. And in religion, you're not supposed to enjoy yourself. Blow yourself up, kill other people, go to war, sit in pews listening to boring sermons on a Sunday, as if like doing a penance. We're not into penances in Buddhism. We're into getting some great peace, stillness and delight and happiness. And as I said on the first night, for anyone who doubts this, we've got the suttas, you know, in the office. I'll get it out for you. The, Dhammacaitya Sutta, where the king said to the Buddha how much he liked going to the Jetavana monastery. Why? Because the monks are always happy and smiling here. In the time of the Buddha, the monasteries had smiling nuns. That's better. Come on, smile. They had smiling monks, happy ones. Have you ever gone to monasteries and temples where all the monks are miserable and they scowl at you? What do you want? Who wants to go to a monastery like that, a temple like that? It's a crazy place. But in the time of the Buddha, the monks were always happy and smiling. And the Buddha said, yes, that is natural. That's what you can expect when their meditation is becoming successful. There you got from the great teacher, the happiness is a natural result when you meditate properly. So anyone who's meditating like this, I'm enduring, I'm going to beat my record, I've done 1 hour, now I'm going to do an hour and a half. It hurts like hell, but I'm going to do this. Get out of here, you don't know what meditation is at all. But if you're meditating, there'll be a smile on your face. And you're so happy and joyful, yeah, carry on. You're getting there. So, it's the happiness of meditation starts to come up, and it starts to get very, very strong. The more you start to bliss out in meditation, the less effort you need. Because it's less effort, the less oxygen your body needs. You're not doing anything. When your car is in the garage, it doesn't eat up much gas, any petrol. So you're putting your mind, your brain in the garage. It's not consuming so much, which means your oxygen intake goes way down. Your metabolism slows down, which means your breath gets very light and very smooth. So light, it disappears. You're not aware of the breath anymore. Now this is all breath meditation. But they call it breath meditation because the breath is the main object, but you don't keep the breath all the time. It's done its job. As I say, that many of you came here from overseas. But unfortunately, your aircraft could not land in Jhana Grove Retreat Center. We don't have a landing strip here for aircraft. You had to get off the aircraft at Perth Airport. And from Perth Airport, it's too far to walk, so you get a car or a taxi or something to get from the airport to here. But you cannot drive the car into your cottage room, so you get out of the car in the car park and you walk the rest of the way. You walk as far as the entrance to your cottage, but your shoes cannot take you any further. They're banned inside the cottage, so you take off your shoes and then you walk barefoot the final distance into your cottage, into your room. Every one of those vehicles has its purpose. Aircraft as far as it can go, car as far as it can go, shoes as far as it can go, and then you walk barefoot with nothing. Just like meditation. The breath can only take you so far. Once the breath is taken to the limit, this beautiful, delightful breath where the breath gets so smooth it disappears, then you let the breath go. The next object which comes up, you know what it's called? The nimitta. Beautiful lights in the mind. Now, first of all, sometimes people, when the breath disappears, they get afraid. I can't feel my breath. I'm going to die. You don't die. I guarantee that. And you say, well, what if I do die? I can't complain afterwards. Yes, you can. Your ghost can come and haunt me for the rest of my life. So you can still get your own back if I'm wrong. But I'm not wrong. You don't die. You just get very peaceful. So don't worry when the breath disappears. Trust this meditation. Trust this whole process. Trust me, for goodness sake. I'm just a pretty well-known teacher by now. I know what I'm talking about. The breath vanishes. Fine. If you don't see a nimitta straight away, then what are you aware of? You're not dead, you're not unconscious, you're aware of something. So I said, what am I aware of right now? Breath disappeared, can't see a light, what is it? Because after a little while, in that state, nimittas come. Beautiful lights. Suddenly just flash and then they disappear again. This is the ninth stage of Anapanasati. Being aware of the citta, that is what it is. The pabbasara citta, it is the mind you are watching, your mind. And if it flashes up and disappears, it's only because you are still too restless, still doing too much. Uh-oh, going over time again. Anyway, the answer to the problem of nimittas come up and they disappear, and they come up and they disappear. The great master Ajahn Chah, his simile of the still forest pool. That's a brilliant simile. That helped me so much in nimittas. Because the Nimittas would come out, it happens to everybody, they flash up first of all, and then they disappear, and then they come, and they're not still, and they can't keep them, and just wondering, how the heck can I keep these things? And then good old Ajahn Chah made a simile, a metaphor. Because when you were wandering in Thailand as a young monk, the tradition was, he told me, try and find a lake or a river, a pond, somewhere mid-afternoon, maybe 3 o'clock, so that you could wash your robes, maybe bathe yourself, and certainly to filter some water for drinking. And then once you've found that water, and you've bathed and drunk, and filled up your water bottle, then put your mosquito net maybe about 10 or 20 meters away from the water's edge, and you can actually stay there overnight. And that's just what the forest monks used to do. And he said, becoming nostalgic about his time when he could wander all over the place in Thailand, he said sometimes instead of meditating at night time, he would keep his eyes open. Because at night time, especially like tonight, full moon nights when you can see really clearly, the jungle animals come to the lake or to the river to drink and also to play. You know, just these were the days before National Geographic or Nature channels on TV. And the reason why those channels are very successful is because watching animals in the wild play around is just delightful. And so there, Ajahn Chah would keep his eyes open. These animals would come out from the forest to play by the pool and to drink. But, he said, they'd only come out when he was perfectly still. Because if he moved, the animals would know there was a human being there. And it doesn't matter how scared you are of things like tigers and elephants and bears. There's more tigers are killed by human beings than human beings by tigers. We are the dangerous animal, by far. So if those tigers see there's a human being there, they get terrified. Even though they were thirsty, they would run back in the bush to hide. But, he said, sometimes he was so still, sitting there, eyes open, so still, the tigers and other animals would come out, see if they could sniff anybody. He didn't move, so they didn't know he was there. So they'd come out with their cubs and play around by the still fire. It was delightful watching these animals, and they didn't know he was there. Just like the Nimittas. If you move, they know that someone is watching, and they will run away again, and they won't come out, maybe for days. But if you can watch those Nimittas, like there's nobody watching at all, like they don't know that someone is observing them, you're that still. No, wow, this is good. Oh, this is a bit too much. No movement at all. And then those Nimittas come out and play. First of all, maybe coming and going a little bit, and then staying. Becoming stable and getting brighter and more intense. So intense. This happens on these retreats. People come and say, interview, I saw this brilliant Nimitta. I had to stop because I would go blind. You don't go blind. Yes, I'm wearing glasses now, but not because of Nimitta, because of old age. It's a mind object, not seeing it with your physical eyes. They can be as bright as they possibly can. They can be brighter than the sun. That's what it feels like. But you don't go blind, so don't be afraid. And don't think, ooh, maybe this is okay for monks and nuns, but not like me. No, in the time of the Buddha, lay people got jhanas and deep meditation, so why not you? So just let it be. And the other problem sometimes, oh, it's so delightful. That's one of the other... When somebody else came in to interview and they told me this, I was really just so happy because, you know, it just reminded me the first time that I had this feeling. These Nimittas are just so intense. So intense happiness. I thought, no human being can endure so much pleasure. It's a nice little fear, isn't it? You can't endure so much happiness. You can explode. But I've discovered a great insight. There's no limit to the amount of happiness and pleasure you can endure. Go for it. You don't explode. Isn't that a wonderful insight? Delight and happiness without limit. Not dangerous at all. So you really start blissing out big time now. Limit gets stronger and stronger. But if you get a little bit excited, if you have a little bit of anticipation, oh, jhanas are coming, jhanas are coming, then it all disappears and you've got to start all over again. For those of you who remember the old children's game, Snakes and Ladders, it is like always the last square before you get home. It's always the longest snake, and that's what it's like. You're almost into jhanas, and you land just one step before you go all the way back down to beginning again. That really sucks when that happens. Oh, crikey. But at least you learn. Next time, be still. And get into the incredible, beautiful states. That is Anapanasati. Mindfulness of the breath. Start with just simple things. Be aware of your body. And you see, on this little talk, stage by stage, every stage you can do. Not hard, as long as you don't interfere and do things otherwise, start to control. It's just what happens when you meditate. So little by little, meditation on the breath. As much time as you possibly can, doing some sitting meditation. But make it quality time. If you're tired, do some walking meditation. Have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee, whatever it is. Take a rest. So don't just force it. When the mind really feels it wants to meditate, that's when you make the most progress. Not because you have to. Not because, yeah, I've been coming here a long time, I should be doing much better than this. No, don't ever think like that. Listen to your body, listen to your mind, and then the meditation gets really beautiful, really deep. And when you come up with a big smile on your face in interviews, that is the best gift you can offer to me, honestly. People always keep asking, what can I get you, Ajahn Brahm? You know, you've helped me. Do you want anything? Actually, that's what I want. To see that beautiful, stupid smile on your face. You've got jhana for the first time. Oh, that's just so sweet. So, who knows? This might be your retreat. Da 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 da. Sadhu. Sadhu. Sadhu! Okay. Okay, have a wonderful morning. But hopefully I'm not getting you to go striving this morning. Yes, jhana, today's the day, I'm going to do it. Don't do that stupid stuff. Okay, I never told you about the teddy bears. Maybe I'll tell you about the teddy bears tomorrow. Okay, see that one over there? Totally silent, totally peaceful. That's... Is that jhana, do you reckon? Okay. Okay, have a good one.